Jesus wore. Oh, when he wore. When Jesus wore. He washed my sins away.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to talk about... I'm going to actually do a special commentary to follow up on why we are so quick and it is so easy to criticize people from other countries. As Trump said, these are S-holes, without looking at what we have done specifically. And today I want to give you a history lesson, completely accurate, showing that we are the primary creators of the environments from which these people originate. And I'm not even dealing with the social issues or the exploitation of the resources. I'm only going to keep it on military. So this is going to be interesting. If you want to know why people are coming to our country from El Salvador, or why they're leaving African countries and trying to go to Northern Europe, that'll be my commentary. Then we're going to talk, of course, about the latest in health and nutrition. I'm going to give you a more in-depth understanding of the virtues of hemp, what could be the most unappreciated and misunderstood crop in the world. Special research from Paul Fassa from Health Impact News. Also today, I'm going to share with you how the National Security Agency tracks everything you do. Now, you have to pull back far enough to see the pieces. The most powerful corporation in the world is Google, and in my opinion, it is one of the most nefarious. It certainly provides us with forums and information. That's a good thing. But it also monitors everything we do and shares this with the federal government and spy agencies. That's not a good thing. And the same is done with Facebook. So I've invited Paul Binney, one of the first whistleblowers and one of the creators of the National Security Agency and one of the creators of its spy system. And he will be on the air in about half hour from now, sharing some in-depth insights that we are not aware of. Scary information. Now, that's one part of the puzzle. But now we have to bring in robotics, taking the place of our jobs. And it's unseen. Most people are never in a factory. Out in Indiana, Illinois, now, they're not aware of what's going on up in Michigan or Maine. There was a factory. It was making something. But now they have machines making that, machines that you don't have to worry about paying, doesn't take sick leave, paternity leave, can't go on strike, and the initial costs are offset very quickly by the savings. We're looking at massive amounts of robotics. But then there's another piece of the puzzle. Offshoring. We, I believe, had at least some conversation, at least during the election cycle, almost never beyond that, of what happens when we choose to take a company that had been in a community for a long period of time and was the primary source of most people's income and hence standard of living, and understand something. When you have a local person working at a living wage, the money from that person's salary circulates about 70 times within a community. Barbara works in the office at a factory. She then goes and gets her hair done. She goes and buys groceries. She goes and buys clothes. She buys clothes for children. She goes to the movies. Barbara also buys a car. Barbara goes to a drive-in. All the things that this one person will do in a given week circulates that money in the local community. But when a corporation comes in, it doesn't. It extracts the money it minimizes the labor, and it might only circulate 6 times. So when we wonder why many communities are drying up, why small businesses can't stay afloat, it's because we don't have enough money in the pockets that is disposable income to have a standard of living that we once had from 1950 to 1975, 25 years, working class, middle class, white collar, blue collar, could circulate money in a community without debt. They didn't have credit cards and they had savings. But you could get about 5 to 6% interest on your savings. Today, you don't get anything. And as a result, it's great for people who want to borrow money at zero interest, banks and corporations. It's terrible for people who want to grow their money and can't unless you start taking risks. And they get you both ways. They control where you put your money on a risk, and they take your money and give you nothing in return. In some cases, actually negative return. And we accept this. So that's one of the issues that I'm going to deal with. And I'll give you real numbers on what's happening with our economy. And by the way, I want to let you know that there's four ways you can listen to this program, Monday to Friday and Tuesday, 7 to 8. And by the way, for all of you who listened last night, we had a lot of people who listened last night. I didn't even announce it. A 2.5-hour special on the Clintons. Not an attack job on the Clintons. I don't know them personally. I don't judge them on a personal level. I judge them based upon their record. And if you knew everything that is presented, factually presented, by people who are not journalists, they're not ideologues, they're not political opponents, they're just people such as state troopers that work with them in Arkansas, state prosecutor, district attorneys, U.S. attorneys, head of drug enforcement agencies in the state. Everyone that was interviewed that was in this special last night, 2.5 hours, are all credible people. You never heard of any of them. You never heard these stories. Also, the Clinton cash in Haiti, using only that one country as an example of how they exploit an entire nation to their advantage and their friends, and why. As one of the people said, a former state Supreme Court justice in Arkansas who was interviewed, Bill Clinton didn't do it originally for money, he did it for power. And you can see the consequences. So my question was this. If you had an advantage by knowing everything about a person's background, everything they had done prior to hiring them or befriending them or electing them to be the most powerful person in the world, would it change your vote? Would you look for someone else? All this information was kept from the 66 million Americans who voted for Hillary Clinton and will likely vote for her again. If you think she's not going to run for president again, you are grossly living in denial. Everything that they're doing, everything right now, with not just her, but with the machine, is to get her ready for the next election cycle because they think it'll be a slam dunk. After all, Donald Trump has the lowest approval ratings of any president since they've been recording approval ratings. The lowest previous to this was 39%, which was Bill Clinton after his first year in office. He's at 29 and dropping like a lead balloon. And they realize that he's not going to honor the promises to his key constituents, and so it'll probably be around 29%. That's a shoo-in for her. So next week, you'll have 2 days, if you didn't hear this special last night, to get a different point of view. What you do with it's up to you. It's just information, but it's important information. So anyhow, you can listen to the radio, your land-based radio. Good. You can listen over the internet. All right. You can call on a telephone. I'll give you that number and listen. 424-203-8046. That's 424-203-8046. But something brand new that makes it real easy, there's an app now for PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network, on your cell phone. Go to the store on your cell phone that has all the apps, and you'll see PRN.FM. Now you get that, and now everywhere you go, anywhere where that gets a signal in the world, you can listen or download shows and archives. Let's begin. First, we're going to start with health and healing, as we always do. And I want to start with hemp, and that's because people are frequently confused. Is smoking marijuana the same as taking a capsule filled with the cannabinoids? No, it is not. Completely different. One will have only beneficial effects. The other will have a mild, calming effect, but provide more carcinogenicity than smoking cigarettes. So there are serious health consequences. Should it be legal? Absolutely. But understand there is a consequence to your lungs and to your health when you smoke. Now, it also provides pain relief, but so does an opiate. So does heroin. So does morphine. So when you have opium and you have heroin, you have morphine, you're in la-la land. They all have terribly toxic side effects. So understand I'm talking about hemp. Now, there is a difference between marijuana and hemp. The confusion between those two terms has cost us the benefits of industrial hemp, which can do a lot of what other materials are doing with much less ecological damage than what exists now. Now, according to Paul Fassa of Health Impact News, hemp is the most misunderstood and underappreciated crop there is. And the confusion between marijuana and cannabis and hemp has made growing hemp without THC illegal only in this country, the United States. It's legal everywhere else. We get most of our hemp products, especially hemp seeds and oils, from Canada and some from Europe. Now, both regions have relatively thriving hemp agriculture and industrial enterprises, and even theirs are not enough to soothe an ecological unbalanced planet. China grows 90% of the world's hemp. And in fact, there's a person who is an expert on this, and he's president of Real Hemp. His name is George Blankenbaker. And in an interview done at a cannabis summit, he talked about offering insight on the medicinal cannabis properties and its surrounding legal and social issues. And what he reveals that has been kept from humanity in addition to cannabis medical qualities is staggering. Here's the difference. Basically, hemp and at one level is the same species of cannabis plants with different strains of THC. THC stands for tetrahydrochloride levels. Now, the tetrahydrochloride levels in the marijuana cannabinoid compound is considered bad because it's psychoactive. Well, it's not bad because it's psychoactive, and it's only mildly psychoactive, and in many people it's not psychoactive at all, but it produces no negative psychoactive impact. It chills people out. Now, the THC, or the tetrahydrochloride, also combines with other cannabinoids in the plant to be probably the single most healing plant on earth, more than ginseng, more than gota cola, dong quai, pho thai. These are all very powerful plants, including, believe it or not, even more powerful in its healing than curcumin from the turmeric plant. Technically, industrial hemp, which includes the hemp seeds and oils, has less than 0.3% THC. And while cannabis, that which you would use and historically has been used for recreational use, that is considered marijuana, contains 0.3% THC and much more, meaning it's 0.3 and up and versus 0.3 and down. Now, pure cannabinoid, which is called CBD, that's the non-THC extract that's been seen with enormous success. I highly recommend it for children suffering from chronic seizures, autism, ADD and ADHD symptoms, any form of vaccine, injured brain, all these neurological conditions. And I also would recommend it for multiple sclerosis, ALS, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and memory loss. Now, that is actually a product of industrial hemp. So CBD, the cannabinoid, was featured on CNN by Dr. Sanjay Gupta. And here's a short presentation of that presentation. It says, quote, states that do not allow medical marijuana abide by the federal law's ban on growing even industrial hemp. This excludes many forms of the benefits of CBD, usually for their neurologically affected children. It also includes many others from an extremely nutritious, healthy food, hemp seeds or oils. Hemp seeds and oils provide a complete protein as amino acids, making it easier to assimilate than animal proteins, which demands powerful enzymes produced by the pancreas to breaking them down to assimilate into amino acids. Most health experts consider the balance of 3-to-1 of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids almost perfect and includes omega-9 to round out a complete fatty acid profile. As plant-based foods, they are high in fiber. You can buy hemp seeds from most health food stores, but they would be a lot less expensive if hemp seed were homegrown in the United States instead of imported from Canada. The nutrition from hemp seeds is so complete that if it were not illegal, people would thrive on growing and consuming their own and to survive a commercial food collapse. But we have those laws against growing it combined with too much ignorance of hemp's food survival potential. Those laws started accumulating after the turn of the 20th century and were further fueled by marijuana fears and corporate greed in the 1930s to ensure tree-produced paper and synthetic fibers and petrochemical plastics and fuels remained dominant. The 1970 Banned Substance Act was the final legal nail in the coffin of hemp cultivation. And during the American colonial and earlier republic periods, hemp growth was required by law. You had to grow it in colonial America. The United States Constitution was written on hemp paper. And due to the Japanese takeover of the Southeast Asia and the Philippines, import hemp fiber shortages loomed for manufacturing rope and canvas during World War II. Then the government was forced to endorse and promote hemp agriculture with a film called Hemp for Victory, which turns out to be historically, agriculturally, industrially highly informative. After the war, documents for producing hemp and this film were removed or hidden in an attempt to discourage the population from learning the truth about hemp. It was reportedly recovered in the 1980s by industrial hemp activist, end quote. Well, here's what we have to understand. Hemp for nutritional edible seeds, hemp used in plant strains that are not as tall as fiber stock plants to access seeds without removing the plants, like a sunflower plant. While the taller plants displayed in different videos have different levels of stock fiber materials, they can be used for other industrial applications. Hemp plants are hardy. They can manage without herbicides. You don't need phosphate fertilizers. They don't have to be grown with the commercial practices now. You can grow them organically. They actually benefit the soil. They're great to plant and then plow under because they enrich the soil. You can actually use them for rotational crops. From seed to harvest, there is less than 1 year. It takes under a year to grow it. In fact, in 1941, Henry Ford built and tested his vegetable car. Most people are not aware of this. It was a prototype from hemp and other plant fibers, and it was very durable and ran on biodiesel fuel that doesn't pollute nearly as much as petrochemical fuels, and his intent was to legalize hemp and help farmers benefit financially. Well, today, practically every type of plastic can be made from hemp. It's biodegradable, it's non-toxic, it will not pollute landfills or the ocean, It will not overburden the ecological systems of water systems the way plastic does that lasts forever. Hemp biodegrades down. And paper from hemp could displace the highly destructive and environmentally toxic wood pulp produced paper. In fact, 1 acre of hemp can produce more oxygen from CO2 and methane than 25 acres of forest, from where trees cut down take years to replace, actually decades. Hemp can be fully grown in less than 1 year. Now imagine if we began to plant, and I've always had this idea that we should be at the state level with local activists writing and promoting and lobbying in their legislature to have 100 trees minimum. That's a minimum. That's just a start in every state, including desert states. We should plant 100 million trees per state. And what if we planted hemp trees? Where the other average tree might take 20 years, this takes under a year. And think if we start using this in all of our plastics, then we wouldn't have to be continuing all the contamination. And synthetic textiles, like rayon, manufacturing products, produces a lot of pollution, and the clothes that are processed releases toxins from that process to the people who wear them. Hemp clothing would be safer. You wouldn't have any outgassing. And there's all kinds of hemp clothing now available. And so I believe that hemp has been proven to be the healthiest plant on the planet. We should be using it. And we're not. Now, that doesn't even get into the idea that's hemp. That with the cannabinoids, which is a different product, we could be helping cure so many people and improve their conditions and helping people relieve pain as well. For those of you who want to improve your brain, for those who want to get rid of some of your amyloid beta protein plaques in the brain, which is a hallmark signal that you have dementia, memory loss, brain damage, and are headed towards Alzheimer's, according to the Nagoya City University in Japan, use phosphatidylcholine. Phosphatidyl, let me spell it for you. PHOSPHATIDYLCHOLINE. Phosphatidylcholine, very important nutrient. Why? Because it protects neurons from toxic effects of the amyloid beta protein. And the researchers there discovered this, and they published an article about how it could help with the brains of people with Alzheimer's. And it was also suggested the interaction of the beta with the membrane cholesterol is essential for a beta to exert neurotoxicity. And so when you're having this, you're helping to clear up the brain. So it's important, if you know anyone who has Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, I would suggest starting off with 200 milligrams twice a day of phosphatidylcholine. And there was recently a congress on the science of polyphenol. Now, I'm a big believer in polyphenols. I've been researching it for a long time. But more importantly, I see how good it does in people who start using the polyphenols. Now, the polyphenols is not a vitamin. It's merely the natural constituents that you find in a healthy plant-based diet. And it turns off almost all of the low-grade inflammation in the body. Let's say you go out one night and you have alcohol. You don't get drunk. You just socially drink. And you get home. Well, you may feel all right, but I can assure you your liver is inflamed, your kidneys inflamed, your heart is inflamed, and your brain is inflamed. Your stomach is inflamed, your intestines inflamed. You may or may not experience any of those inflammations, but they're there. So by having any of the polyphenols, you're going to have something that will turn off the low-grade inflammation markers in the body. blueberries, raspberries, pomegranates, strawberries, cherries. Yeah, that's what will do it. And papaya and mango are also good in that. So this is a study that just talked about how powerful these are. So have that. And also even in olive oil, really good quality olive oil turns off low-level inflammation in the body. And finally, from the International Research Services, published in the Journal of Cosmetic Dermatology, zeaxanthin, that's a nutrient, very important nutrient. It's good for our skin, good for our eyes, very good for vision. You don't need a lot, 10 milligrams. But this says that it's good for the skin from within. Quote, dietary supplements of carotenoid zeaxanthin with sea buckthorn fruit oil may reduce wrinkles in women. That's good. Well, anything that can reduce wrinkles, most people would appreciate. But I tell you, the best thing you can do right off is just super hydration. Most people don't realize that we dehydrate all the time. We don't drink as much liquid after we exercise as we can frequently lose during exercise. And even during a day, your feet will perspire about a quart or more of sensible, insensible, or massive perspiration out of the feet. But because it's absorbed through the socks or if we wear sandals, we don't notice it. But I can tell you this, what if your shoes and your socks did not absorb anything but rather pulled it? So at the end of the day, as you take off your shoe, you could pour out the amount of water that the body expelled. You go, wow. And then you think, well, what did I? Well, I had a lot of coffee today. No good, because coffee is a diuretic. It takes more water out of the body. I had a cola. Not good. That takes out more water out of the body. So you got to really hydrate, and not all at once, but throughout the day. And juices are particularly good to rehydrate, and then you take zeaxanthin, and then along with hydration and that, you're going to have healthier, younger, less wrinkled skin. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. Nice to be with you. By the way, I just got word from Luann Panessi that our first week of our health retreat in April is full. Thank you. That'll be a lot of fun. Looking forward to it. And this coming Sunday evening, I think it's going to be the beginning of a major campaign. I know it is, because I know all the different activists from different groups around the world who are all going to be listening at 7:30 when I commence Deadly Deception for about an hour and 45 minutes, then followed by a panel of experts from around the world who are going to give insights into why we have all been lied to about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. It is one of the most scandalous public health frauds in history. And these are really heavyweight people. We took a lot of time to find people you did not know from different parts of the world who have done their homework, and their reputations are solid. So it's going to be a must-watch evening. So go to GaryNoll.com or PRN.FM and sign up. You'll be given the information on how to tune in. And it's going to be a long evening. Starts at 7:30 and goes to about 10:30. So but wow, what information. Pack, pack, pack. World premiere. Activist organizations all over the world are tuning in. We're expecting between the different groups and the heads of those groups, to have probably somewhere between 4 to 5 million individuals receiving this information by others, getting information on. We'll also have a brand new article. I will read that article on Friday's program, and that's also going to go out the same day, a brand new article that no one's ever seen this information before. We've been working on it for over 9 months. So that's this Sunday evening. And remember, they're making it mandate. They're working behind every closed door they can at every state to make sure that you as your children are vaccinated. But then they're going to get employers involved so adults won't be able to go to work unless they first are given all these vaccines. And then they're going to include dozens upon dozens of new vaccines that you must or your kid must take. Why not? They're making $100 billion a year, and they have no legal liability. We're also going to be working on that. They're going to be fighting back. They're already aware of it, and they're going to start a whole campaign to try to attack everyone who is involved in this, but so be it. We are fighting on behalf of children. They're fighting on behalf of greed. We do not have anyone in Congress on our side, nor in the media. We do not have the scientific community or the medical community on our side. The nurses, the pharmacists, the physicians are all on their side. Your child is nothing more than an income source. And we, on the other hand, we have none of the power. We have none of the heavyweights on our side. But we do have truth. And we have Anonymous. And brother, the one group you never want to go against, never. You go against Anonymous, they'll hand you your ass in a basket. Who do you think provided the documentary that we showed last night? Anonymous. Yeah, they can bring down a government. That's how powerful. So, and they know everything. So, that's Sunday night. It begins a major battle to take back our freedom of choice, and to protect our children from the corporate interests, the oligarchs, and the deep state. Now, before we go to William Benny and my commentary, let's say hello to Elizabeth, who takes your emails, where you email prnstudio@gmail.com. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. We've got two questions about the same sort of thing, but I'll talk about Tom. He's worked as a school teacher in Brooklyn for over 20 years, and then he retired and went down to Florida, where he now works in real estate, and he lives in a small gated community on the East Coast there. A couple of months ago, he heard you talking about the storms and the hurricanes and the damage, but he said he didn't have anything to do about it where he was, because it's all done for you, the cutting of the grass, lawns, the trimming of the trees. He's never been on a farm or a ranch, and he sort of realized he's disconnected from what life would be like, totally. He heard you say that you've lived on a farm or ranch your entire adult life, practically, but has not heard you discussing what that means and why you chose that. And he'd like to have an idea of him, and or could you please give him and the rest of the audience an idea of what goes on in a day when you live on a farm or ranch? And also, Janice from Detroit, who lives in downtown Detroit, she was asking the same question, what it must be like to live on a ranch.
Okay, well, there is a difference between living on a ranch and living on a farm. Let's say a farm may be where you have organic produce, either one crop or multiple crops. A ranch, you generally have animals. It's generally larger. But both have one thing in common. They're labor-intensive. Let me just give you an idea of yesterday. You get up in the morning. I get up at 4 and do my exercising, training for a race, have my breakfast, what some people have called Gary's mud, because when you look at it, it looks like a bowl of mud. But don't be deceived. There are over 40 different ingredients in there that provide my cells with what they need. And that's all I have until one more meal later in the day. And then I go to work. And the first thing you do when you have animals that are rescued, you have to give them not just food and water in a safe environment. You have to give them your time. After all, when that animal wakes up in the morning, it has no place to go. So you're its world. So that's why I always try to find, even if I have a rescued animal that will take a long time to rehabilitate, I try to find another animal as a companion so they can groom each other and enjoy each other's company. And it works wonderfully to get animals to stop over-grooming. Anytime an animal's highly stressed or depressed or going through mourning, they will over-groom themselves until there's no hair at all. And they'll just sit for hours and do this, and their tails will twitch. They have certain characteristics. So you have to show them that you're their family now, and you're there to love them and play and let them run around an environment and explore it. So you do that, but you have to feed them. Now, I feed all my animals the same food I eat, the same health drink I make in the morning, I make for them. And that's why I believe I have it up there. I haven't looked. But if you go up to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com's website or Gary Nall's website, you should see a photograph of a ring-tailed lemur. Her name is Auntie, and she's 32 years of age. To give you an idea, the average ring-tailed lemur lives between 12 to 15 years. She's over 200 years old in human life, and that makes her the oldest living ring-tailed lemur on the planet by a substantial margin. The oldest one before her was 27 when it died. And she's still healthy. And she goes out every day and sits in the sun, and then she goes and visits all the other animals, and they all give deference to her. There's this understanding that she is the wise old woman. And so I give her special extra nutrients for her heart and her brain and her joints. And then all the other hoof stock, you shouldn't really feed hay. You should feed fresh grasses. But you have to go to the extra effort to have at least, ideally, 5 acres for every two livestock, hoof stock. And then you plant bahia and rye, clovers, coastal, the different combinations of grasses to give them higher percentage of protein. But I give them each a big bowl. It's about 10 pounds. And it's watermelon, cantaloupes, apples, plums, pears, peaches, bananas, cherry tomatoes, sweet potatoes, yams. Each morning they get that. And they eat all of it. Then I have to wash those out, and they let them out into pasture. They all like to come in the barn at night, and I have a special stall for the miniature Zebu cattle, and they would have been killed. I was told by a person, gee whiz, I don't have any place to put them. They were up in Ocala. They weigh about 400 pounds each, and they were going to get $1 a pound, and there were two of them. So I gave $800 and rescued them. The reason they were going to be killed was because they have what's called a slipper foot, meaning that the hoof doesn't stop. It goes way out and curls back up. And you can't really cut that because there are blood vessels in there and they bleed to death. So I was able to slowly trim it down over a period of time to where now their hoofs are almost normal. So in the next 6 months to a year, I'll find them another home. Mine's like an intermediate home, a way station to get them healthy and happy and bonded, and then find them a home in the wilds or in a sanctuary. So then after all the animals are fed and each one's given a different diet, then you have to clean up their environment and get new bedding. And if it's cold, you're going to make sure they have heat lamps. And if it's hot, they have fans. And you actually put a shower in there so they can take showers. And then they're all running around at different times of the day, climbing trees and doing things that are important. And then after a storm, you have to clean up the property. And that takes a lot of work with chainsaws and cutting down branches that are broken, repairing fencing. And then you take a break in the afternoon for doing a radio show, then later go back to work. And then you fertilize the ground with natural compost to get minerals back in there. Check your irrigation systems. And that's just part of a day working on a ranch. Now, if there's a garden, then you have to spend time in the garden as well. It's, why do I do it instead of a gated community like the guy who has everything done for him? Because you're close to the nature, you're putting your hands in the soil, you're not confined by neighbors and noise and pollution. You can live in a really beautiful harmony between nature, the trees, the flowers, the plants, the purity of that environment, and it rebalances you and re-energizes your chi. And now, if I'm not challenging people who live in gated communities, if that's what they want and they feel that's important to them, that's their right. But there's something special when you're closer to nature, where you don't have to look out on a manicured lawn where everyone's playing golf on an artificial little pond where they're spraying more pesticides than any place else in America is on golf courses. It's a different way of living. Not for everyone, but I've lived my whole adult life on a farm or a ranch. Okay?
That's very nice. Thank you. That sounds lovely.
Thank you. Now, let's go over and hear William Binney talking about how much of a prisoner we are today to the National Security Agency deep state. And keep in mind, I mentioned robotics, I mentioned offshoring, I mentioned gathering intelligence on us. What I left out was artificial intelligence, because once they know everything about you, once they have a tremendous amount of information on everything you do, everything you buy, everything you watch, every communication you've ever sent, every phone call you've ever had, they have it, and they're processing it. Then they can create artificial intelligence that absorbs that information and then knows how to relate to you, and then they could actually have that artificial intelligence be brought into your life where you actually want it brought into your life. If you're lonely, it's suddenly a voice to talk about anything and everything about you because it knows every single thing about you. And that's dangerous. Do you really want the capacity of a government and corporations to know everything you've ever thought? Because remember, once they get into the neuron system of the brain, you have about 100 million messages per decade of life. So everything you've ever thought, everything you've ever done, everything you've ever wanted to do, it's in your brain. They're going to know that. There's no secrets that they can't find. And then what are they going to do with that information? That is happening as we speak. Here's Mr. Binney.
Very honored and proud to present you Bill Binney on the stage. And he will be telling us the perspective from the inside of the NSA, because he was a technical director of the NSA for many years and worked in the intelligence services for more than 37 years. He is a child of the Cold War and worked throughout the Cold War decrypting and breaking ciphers from the adversaries of the US. And back then he used to call himself the technical director of the world, in a sense. So please give it away for how the NSA tracks you with Bill Binney.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to say it's nice to be back in large numbers of people with character and integrity, which when I worked at NSA, not too many people had. I was all looking at military and governmental encryptions and codes and activity. But the same techniques apply to any crypt system. I mean, it's not something that, and I was on the offensive side, not the defensive side. And I know, I knew Snow and the defensive people. And I went to talk to them once about saying, here, I had all these solutions on the offensive side. And can you tell me how you're designing the defensive side? Because I thought that they should be parallel. You know, what we were doing, they were doing, and they wouldn't tell me. So that shows you the same kind of, there's that kind of communications now, like for example for cybersecurity, all the attacks that have come out of Vault 7 and the NSA exposures, hundreds of millions of lines of source code on attacks on firewalls, switches, servers, operating systems, all of that. That's thousands of attacks. And we've only seen a few of them so far used in the world. And you can just be ready for a much rougher ride because the offensive side knew all these things were weak and existing. The defensive side didn't, and they never fixed anything. So we were all vulnerable, so we all got attacked. And so now they say every time you get attacked, we need more money, more people, more empire. You know, so it's a swindle. We're all being swindled by our governments. If they would only fix the things they knew that were wrong, we might have some security, you know. So, but instead they don't. So at any rate, when I left NSA, I did that at the end of October 2001 because they started spying on individuals and not groups of bad guys, okay? So that meant they were scooping up everything from everybody in the world. And it's much more extensive than anybody thought. It's more extensive than even the slides show. And in order to store all this material, they had to build the Bluffdale 1 million square foot facility for storing data. Last year they broke ground for a 2.8 million square foot facility on Fort Meade. It took out a 36 hole golf course to do it. So, I mean, the point is, if you collect everything as an ever increasing amount of data year after year, which means you need ever-increasing data storage facilities to store it all. The way we found out about this was to look at every time the government wants to build something, they have to file an environmental study. So when they wanted to put in this very large building, they had to also submit an environmental impact statement and study to do it before they did it. So we're looking at those and seeing what they're building. So when they do that, we know, this is on Fort Meade, and it's NSA doing it. So, you know, virtually everything on Fort Meade is NSA anyway. So that gave us the knowledge of the scale of what they're collecting and what they're assembling. For example, in Cisco, who sold them the routers to route data to the Utah facility, estimated, there was a small article they wrote years ago, that estimated that by 2015, the amount of data going into the Utah facility would be 966 exabytes a year. That's about a zettabyte. So that's why originally, years ago, I estimated that the capacity of Utah was about 5 zettabytes. I mean, it's my guess, you know, it's a lot of bytes anyway. So at any rate, I felt I didn't have to take anything with me because everybody in Congress, when I left, they all knew me. They knew what I was doing. Most of what they're doing to spy on everybody, I designed anyway or had a hand in it. So they knew all that. So I felt I didn't have to bring any material out to validate anything I was saying because they all knew I did it. So I naively thought that I could do that and go complain through the channels, the intelligence committees and the inspector generals, and they would all take some action on it. Well, what it really meant was when it came time to actually hearing what I had to say, Congress never invited me in. I mean, I testified in the Bundestag, I testified in the House of Lords in the UK, but the Congress would never hear me because then they'd lose plausible deniability. That was really their key. They needed to have plausible deniability so they could continue this massive spying program because it gave them power over everybody. Everybody in the world. Even the members of Congress had power against others. They had power on the judges in the Supreme Court, the federal judges, all of them. That's why they're so afraid. Everybody's afraid because all this data they had about them, the central agencies, the intelligence agencies, they have it. And that's why Senator Schumer warned President Trump earlier, a few months ago, that he shouldn't attack the intelligence community because they've got, you know, 6 ways to Sunday to come at you. That's because it's like J. Edgar Hoover on super steroids. They have the same kind of data that J. Edgar Hoover had on everybody. So it's leveraged against every member of parliament and every government of the world. When Edward Snowden came out, he came out with material and slides and publications by the government about the programs they were running. That gave me, and that was the stuff I left them, so it gave me all the opportunity to pull it together and say, this is what they're doing, this is how they're doing, this is what it means. And that's what I've been trying to do. So I assembled some slides here to give you some idea, hopefully, a better idea of what's going on. And I also assembled some slides to show you what they should be doing. I have only one case of an unclassified version of big data analysis, which is what they should be doing, and they aren't. That's why people are getting killed. That's why I said in the UK that bulk data kills people, because all the analysts in the UK and in MI5 and in GCHQ, similarly in the FBI and NSA, they're buried in data and they can't see what's happening because there's just too much data. And they're using the old techniques of word searches and stuff like that. That's not the way to do it at all. It's social networking is the key to solving all of these problems, solving them quickly, and making all the data content problem a manageable thing. Now, I'll take you into that. So here, these are the ways that they basically collect data. First, they use the corporations that run the fiber optic lines, and they get them to allow them to put taps on them, and I'll show you some of the taps where they are. And if that doesn't work, they use the foreign government to go at their own telecommunications companies to do the similar thing. And if that doesn't work, they'll tap the line anywhere they can get to it, and they won't even know it. Nor the governments, nor the communications companies will even know they're tapped. So that's how they get into it. Then they get into the fiber lines. And this is the PRISM program is really where they have the companies involved. That's down there, and a list of them. This came out, was one of the first things that was published out of the Snowden material, and it all focused on PRISM. Well, PRISM is really the minor program. I mean, the major program is upstream. That's where they have the fiber optic taps on hundreds of places around in the world. That's where they're collecting off the fiber line all the data and storing it. PRISM was simply their way of putting out something where Congress and the courts could look at it and say, well, we're abiding by the law. See here, we asked these companies for this data and we have a warrant for that to do it. So you see, we're abiding by the law. When in upstream, they were taking everything off the line. Also, the muscular program was a parallel one, which basically did the Yahoo and Google and a couple others. They unilaterally tapped lines between their data centers when they transferred data to back it up and so on. They got everything they had, and they didn't know it. And PRISM was only one small input to the data that NSA was collecting. Worldwide, these are the kinds of things they have. I mean, it's satellites, it's all kinds of collection. The real big one is over there at CNE, Computer Network Exploitation. That's where they're implanting either with hardware or software, both, into switches and servers around the world, and they can make them do anything they want because they own them. So if you send data anywhere through those switches or servers, and there's tens of thousands of them in the world, they basically own the network. So all of that is feeding another program that they call Treasure Map. And this one just says, well, we want to know where everything is in the world every minute of the day. So it's not just collecting what you're saying, encrypted or not, but it's also monitoring where you are when you do it. And that's basically done by, this is a kind of the geography of the world, and there's the physical layout of the fibers and the microwaves and the satellite towers and everything. And then that maps to that physical network, and then logical networks, who's communicating across them. That maps to equipment, which in turn maps to people, and that's how they follow everybody. This is also when you have cell phones, for example, how they take GPS and use the drones to target people. So I think Jacob Applebaum was the one who said some NSA tracks them and CIA whacks them, right? And the way they do that, and there's 1.2 million people on the drone list, according to the last number I saw. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, they aren't verifying who they're hitting. They're not, I mean, they're just going to kill people all the time. This is insane. I call that program random slaughter, because that's about what it is. And this is why I get in their face every time I possibly can in the U.S., because they're doing stupid stuff. It's hurting a lot of people. But anyway, that's the treasure map. All the material they collect from all the sources goes back into these programs, back inside NSA over here on that rectangle over there, or this basically a square fundamentally. this was the entire design. These programs, Mainway and Marina, are basically the graphs of social networks that map into the databases in Pinwheel, the internet, and Nucleon, the voice. There are basically two systems they're following: public switch telephone network, which is all of phones, fixed, mobile, satellite, any kind of phone. All the content data then goes into Nucleon, and it's indexed up there by the Marina program, so that when they want to see who did what, they have an index all to everything they ever said in their database. This was the whole design. I left them, and they haven't changed a damn thing in 15 years, 16 years. So that's real progress for you. But at any rate, one of the things to look over here on the side is that both CIA and the FBI, through the FBI Center in Quantico, Virginia, have a direct access into these databases and the entire graph. Not only that, but they also use that for police around the world. So it's a straight violation of everything. All this data is collected without warrants. So, it's a basic violation of the rights of every human in a court of law, and that's what they're using. They're using it to arrest people, and then they pull a substitution. I've got some slides on that, too. And these are other people who have access to it. The Five Eyes group over here, they have direct access into the NSA database right here. And so do the Drug Enforcement Administration, Defense Intelligence Agency, FBI, CIA. All these people have direct access to all this data. And it's children's data as well. It's everybody on the line because they take it all. So it's nothing, there's no distinction. They don't filter anything. It's just capture everything. This is what General Alexander said in Menwith Hill Station a few years ago. He said, all we have to do is collect it all. And that's what they're doing. The problem is, once you collect it all, And they have the impression, or they give the impression, that data is intelligence, right? When you collect more data, you have more intelligence. It's not. The point is, you have intelligence when you understand the meaning of what you've collected. If you can't do that, I mean, you have nothing but a bunch of data. And that, unfortunately, that's the perspective they have. So they.
That is merely one of five parts we'll be playing over the next 2 weeks of Wim Binney, one of the founders of the National Security Agency's programs that spy on us. And as you just heard him say, they're illegally spying on us every day, every single piece of communication, and every one of those images from highways, from walking down the street, from walking into a building, they're collecting every single one of those. And they're building a profile on all of us. So, and no one is protesting it. That's unfortunate. Maybe by the end of this, you'll see why we should. We're at the end of our program. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.